And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to a Monday edition of The Low Post podcast, where some traditions must be honored even amid the worst and most tumultuous of times. And one such tradition is this. It is time to say the three most anticipated words in niche basketball podcasting because of my guest's identity today. So I will start by saying, what up, Beck?
What up, Low? Good to see you. I'm glad we're not just talking, but seeing, thanks to the wonders of technology. How are you?
I'm good. I'm fine. All things considered, I'm fine. I'm lucky. I'm fine. Everything's good. I am not as lucky as you because you had a speaking role in your own voice in Game of Zones. I did not get to speak my lines about the Swamp Dragon. One of the Malamute brothers did that for me. You got to speak your lines. I think you did. I like B, not quite A. I'm not ready to like line you up for regular voice work in different accents, but like decent.
I was, you know, kind of hoping for an Emmy, but you know, maybe that's too much to ask for in my acting debut. But a B, you know, I mean, I'll take that. I have no acting background. I faked one of the worst British accents a person could come up with. But yeah, I got to voice myself in Game of Zone. Like it's like, that's a career highlight, Zach. Like that is like, I could retire right now and there's nothing left to do. There's nothing left to accomplish. Like a Pulitzer, like who cares about a I got to voice myself in Game of Zones with a bad British accent. I don't know how it's going to get any better.
Is there like a 6-hour outtake reel of you mangling the line or trying different variations of the accent and like them having to take breaks because you're so bad? Like, you know what? Let's just take five. Beck, just let's take five, Beck.
They gave me the line months ago, right before the shutdown, and I had said, do you want me to do this in here? Like in their studio, in front of them, which I thought I was going to be too self-conscious. So I did it at home. And I probably, just because I'm a crazy person, I did do probably like 20 takes sitting here at this very desk, trying to get it exactly right and figuring out what my tone was and my cadence was. And yeah, I mean, listen, if you're going to get one acting line in the history of your life for a beloved animated mashup of the NBA and Game of Thrones, you better nail it, right? So, but B, you know, I'll take a B.
There are a lot of basketball fans in the comedy world. Many of them are involved in projects that are in various stages of incubation that are about basketball, right? Like none of these have really ever been made public. A couple have, and then they start and stop because this is how movies work, apparently. There are ideas that sit there and scripts that sit there for 15 years. And I've told them all, if there's a press conference scene, just let me be one of the reporters. Like, I'll wear the stupid hat, like the stupid old school reporter hat, and I'll raise my hand and be like, it's a question. And just let me be that guy and ask. I don't care if the question is dumb. Just give me that opportunity.
I have always wanted to do that as well. Going back to, I think it was the Ali movie, and Bill Plaschke and some of the other LA reporters, maybe Steve Springer, guys at the LA Times. I remember being in one of those scenes and even getting to like, getting one of the, Ali, and like being able to shout out the question and you get your one moment in there. And I think it was the Ali movie. And yes, ever since then, I've thought that would have been the life goal. But Game of Zones, you know, I'll take. On the other hand, while you did not voice your own voice, they did nail a great Zachism within that. So
can we talk about how Russell Westbrook is attacking us right now? That was pretty good, I have to say. And I got a good death. Anyway, the reason you're on this podcast is because you just posted one of your Beck stories, a Beck hit, a long oral history of Game 7 of the 2000 Western Conference Finals between Portland and the Lakers, which is, of course, the infamous, either the famous Lakers comeback or the infamous Blazers collapse, depending on your perspective, culminating in the Kobe to Shaq lob dunk that puts the Lakers up 6, I believe, and ices the game. This has become, you can only do like one of these a year because they take a lot of work and even if it's a flashbulb landmark game from 20 years ago, it's still 20 years ago, and the public appetite for 20 years ago is not ever going to be as strong as like for what's happening right now. But I love to do these stories. I just did one in conjunction with The Last Dance on Game 7 between the Pacers and the Bulls in 1998. And I love it because all these years later, the participants are much more willing to actually tell you the truth about what happened behind closed doors and be candid about how they were feeling and what they remember. I love it because it gives you a chance to really, like, I was much more interested to talk to the Pacers than the Bulls. And I think you probably, as much as your story was about Shaq and Kobe coming together for this moment that signified the cementing of their partnership and gave them a pathway to a three-peat, I bet you were more excited to talk about the Blazers because the losers are always more interesting to talk to, just to get their perspective and, like, the degree to which they still feel that heartbreak 20 years later is just – it just seeps out of your piece.
Yeah. So the heartbreak part of it is interesting. So I talked to, you know, Mike Dunleavy Sr. I also got Mike Dunleavy Jr., who I did not end up using. My apologies to Mike Dunleavy Jr. But he was sitting on the bench for, I think, four of the seven games or behind the bench.
No way.
Yeah. You can see him in the old highlights. So if you watch, especially game seven, Mike Dunleavy Jr. sitting there. He's like 19 years old, just finished his freshman year at Duke. And I figured he was a great perspective because he witnessed all this. So, but I ended up with just so much great material I couldn't use. But I talked to, you know, so I got Scottie Pippen and Damon Stoudemire, Bonzi Wells, Steve Smith, Greg Anthony. So I had five players plus Dunleavy Senior and Junior, five of the Lakers, and in a quick email exchange with Phil Jackson, who did not participate very much. But so because I had so much, there was a lot that I had to just kind of decide to take out. But one of the through lines with the Blazers is that every single person, to a man, without me even asking, most cases said, I've never watched that game and I'm never going to watch that game. It's just too hard. It's too much heartbreak. It still pains me to this day because they're all convinced that if they won that game, they would have won the championship and maybe more than one championship. And the Lakers don't disagree with that. The Lakers all say, yeah, they were that good. Yeah, they would have beaten Indy.
That and Portland team was awesome. And I remember when they built that team, when they acquired Pippen and they were going to run 12 deep and they were going to play all these like giant wingy lineups and like Damon Stoudemire doesn't really even play the fourth. They don't play a point guard the entire fourth quarter of this collapse, which we'll talk about. I love that Portland team. And yeah. I had a friend in college, shout out to Lindsay Moore, who is a huge Lakers fan. And we made a bet before the season even started that the Blazers would get further than the Lakers. Wow. And I took the Blazers, obviously. I think we bet $50. And then we kind of lost track of each other. And obviously the bet came down to this game. And I was feeling myself in the third and fourth quarters. Like, I'm going to win this bet. I'm going to get in contact with Lindsay and get my $50. And I reached out to her on Facebook to see if she remembered this after reading your story. She doesn't remember it. She is now going to charge me interest for not paying, which is completely fair, and I'm going to calculate the interest. But I love that team, and I think what happened in the fourth quarter to them was somewhat baked into the construction of their team in terms of the kind of shots they took and the kind of shots they missed. But I love that team. I went back and watched the game in preparation for this. I loved watching them play even amid a collapse. But you were at the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where are you sitting? Did you see the lob? Could you see it? Could you have a good angle of it?
So one of the reasons I wanted to always go back to this game, and I nearly did this 4 years ago, but the story kind of got shelved for reasons beyond my anyway. So I wanted to go back to it because I was at that game, because I covered that series. I was a Laker beat writer for the Daily News at that time. And it was always one of my favorite moments, one of my favorite series. And that Portland team was one of my favorite teams to have watched play against the Lakers. And obviously the Kings during that era too. But I have always contended that was the best team they faced. And Robert Horry agreed with me and said, in fact, it's the best team he ever played, period, in his life. And Robert Horry has seven championships. So that says a lot. I thought that Blazers team was amazing. And I thought that it's unfair or unfortunate that they've, I think almost been forgotten. Even when SB Nation recently did their thing where they did, the best teams of all time not to win at all. And I think they were like in the third tier or something. And I'm like, I'm convinced, and I don't have, a ton of history before that time in terms of like being immersed in this. So I can't tell you definitively from the 70s or even some of the 80s. But to me, in the time that I've been covering the league in 23 years, that Blazers team is the best team I've seen not make the finals. But the lob happens. We're sitting baseline. Our seats at Staples Center, the beat writers, we sit baseline on the same end of the court as the Lakers. So we are opposite their bench on the baseline, the opposite side of the basket stanchion. So as the play unfolds, Kobe's back is to me. And so when I see this play in my mind's eye all the time, it's always Kobe dribbling against Scottie, crosses him over, and starts to drive. And so as Kobe starts to go up and his hand goes up, I thought he was shooting in the moment. It's a split second, your perceptions, right? I thought he was going to shoot. I did not see Shaq. And Rick Fox, who was on the bench at that time, so he's at the same end of the court as I am, you know, almost 90 feet away, it's the same thing. He said, I didn't see Shaq until I saw Shaq. Like, he just, it's like he came out of nowhere.
Imagine not seeing Shaq. Like, what kind of specific angle do you have to be sitting in where you can't see Shaq?
Well, also, this is part of the, you know, if you let yourself get sucked in as a viewer to watching just the ball. And, of course, why wouldn't I be watching Kobe Bryant going up against Scottie Pippen? Like, my entire focus was there. So I ended up asking various people, or pretty much everybody, for this story. At the time that Kobe drives past Scottie and starts to go into this motion, do you think he's shooting or passing? And it was basically evenly split. And I was glad to see that I wasn't the only one who thought maybe he was going up for a shot. Now, I think it was Robert Horry who pointed out, if you see the way his hand goes up, it's clear it's not really a shooting motion because it's just kind of this little shot put motion. But in the moment, and especially from the perspective that I had from, you know, the baseline watching from his back, I couldn't tell. And I didn't know Shaq was about to jump up.
So the Athletic, much to your chagrin, wrote a different oral history of this game, kind of, that yes. Published the day before yours. And if you add up the quotes in their story and the quotes in your story about this very particular subject, I think it becomes like 2/3, 1/3 people saying they all thought Kobe was going to shoot. Like 2/3 of the quotes are now we all thought Kobe was going to shoot. Which is funny because it's Kobe and normally Kobe shoots. But it's obviously an iconic play. My favorite thing about it has always been Shaq's reaction, which is the wide-eyed, sprinting back, kind of has lost control of his senses and points at, which I didn't remember, the two-handed point, which is to his son, who's in the crowd. And why I love that is because, you know, you hear, like, Gino Auriemma had a rant about this, like, a year or two ago. And I think there's some, it's a little bit of a crotchety old man thing, but I think there's some truth to it about how, sort of, he was talking about raw effort, raw unadulterated effort, and raw unadulterated emotion are not cool. You don't look cool when you're really, really trying hard. And you don't look cool when you're really, really just overwhelmed by the moment and you're making goofy facial expressions and running in goofy ways and jumping around trying to hug people. And I think a lot of athletes, like, being cool is part of the job. And, like, it's no one wants to look uncool in any walk of life. And I love when there are moments where any, even if it's just a little subconscious part of your brain that's like, I gotta keep the persona that I wanna, you know, have the public see. I wanna be cool. Just melts away completely. And you're just a kid out of control, looking goofy. And Shaq was as cool as it came. And that's not a criticism. Shaq is just cool. Yeah. The way Shaq dunked was cool. The way Shaq played was cool. The way Shaq just rolled over people was cool. Shaq broke backboards, the whole deal. In that moment, Shaq is completely uncool. He's completely overwhelmed by it. And it's maybe my favorite Shaq moment ever.
I hadn't thought about it, but it probably would be mine. It certainly should be. I mean, there are some others. I mean, there was a time, I think the first year I covered them, where he gets knocked down. This is, again, the side of the court that's closer to us. This is at the Forum. And he falls down, and instead of just, like, falling plopping to the floor, he spun it into, like, a breakdancing
spin. Yes, that was cool. That's cool. That's what I'm talking about. That's cool. Yeah. That's just cool.
But see, all right, so a couple different thoughts. One is that while Shaq was the ultimate image of cool in a lot of different ways, Shaq was always the overgrown kid. So Shaq never worried about dropping his guard and showing his emotion, whether it was anger or joy or goofiness. He did all kinds of crazy stuff. That's wear crazy ass suit. The suit he wore the day of the, this is really pulling, from the archives. Go look up the Doug Christie versus Rick Fox fight that it's in a preseason game, Lakers Kings, and then Mrs. Christie gets involved and Shaq is back in the hallway because he's injured and he's in this crazy ass suit. Anyway, Shaq never worried about, needing to project cool. He just was cool. So I think he had the latitude to have those moments without ever worrying about it. But the other funny thing about it, Zach, is that when I'm rewatching that game, so Kobe throws the lob to Shaq. And before Shaq comes running down the court with his mouth agape and his eyes bugging out and pointing and all this, he has a quick little slapping five with Kobe. And Kobe's just stone cold. Like, there's no emotion in Kobe whatsoever. There's not even any emotion in Shaq at the moment that they slap hands. But then the timeout is called and Shaq starts running down the court doing all that stuff. And Kobe's still Kobe. Like, there's just no, like, he's just freaking locked in. And Shaq, like, and that's such an imperfect encapsulation of them too. Shaq was always the overgrown kid. Kobe, he's 21 at this point. There's nothing kid-like about him. Sure, there was some immaturity in his game, but in terms of his demeanor, he was totally controlled and hyper-focused. So that contrast is fun too. The other thing, if we were going to get all grumpy old man with Gino Auriemma and agree, in going back through, like, just the archives, going into doing the Nexus dive, and also just talking to these guys now, not only are they really candid about it now and had a lot of stuff to say and a lot of smack to talk as well, both sides, but going back and looking then, they were talking to, like, Phil Jackson referred to the Blazers as jackals for celebrating too much on the bench.
That's, you can't say, Phil.
I love that stuff.
Phil's lexicon of jabs is, jackals is troubling, actually, if you think about it a little bit more than just the first layer of analysis. And that, and culminating in Posse, Phil has had some troubling.
Well, Posse is much more explicitly bad and obviously bad. Jackals was just, I don't know. I'll be honest. I have not looked into the etymology.
Jackals,
my
immediate reaction was, that's troubling.
Yeah.
Was not that's funny. With that's if he said that today, he would be called out on it immediately as troubling.
So, without getting into like the layers of that particular term, because I honestly, as I'm sitting here right now, I'm oblivious, to what else that could imply. But I will just say that my point is generally that Phil talked a lot of Dunleavy talked some stuff. Dunleavy and Rick Fox got into it in the midst of a game because Rick and Scottie Pippen were getting into it, and Dunleavy kind of jumped in because it happened by their bench. There was just a lot of stuff talked by both sides back then, and those Kings-Lakers series used to get that way too. It happens occasionally now, but I think more of the trash talk, which has always been a fun part of this game about this league, it's confined to the court between them. Back then, it was not unusual at all for them to be saying all this stuff between games in interview sessions and scrums. And I just think it was a lot of fun because nobody was so image conscious back then or so brand conscious or worried about who they were going to piss off.
Well, one of the fun things about doing this 20 whatever years later is that you have a quote from Bonzi Wells in which he admits when they're up 71-55 late in the third quarter or up by 15 early in the fourth, he comes out and says, I'm from Indiana. I'm starting to think, yeah, I'm going to go play my hometown team in the finals. How cool is that going to be? And when I wrote the Pacers Bulls story from 98, the Pacers jump out to a 20-7 lead in that game. Mm-hmm. And Jalen Rose was on the Pacers team, told me, hell yeah. We're thinking we're about to blow the freaking Bulls out of the gym and go to the finals. And Derek McKee and Dale Davis, who's a key factor in the aftermath of your story, both on that Pacers team, told me, yeah, during the conference finals, I'll admit it, like, I let it get enter my brain that I think we match up pretty well with Utah. Like, I think we can win the championship if and when we get to the finals. Players will never say that at the time, because it's sacrilege, it's heresy, it's bulletin board material, but it is so completely human when you're up 16 in the fourth quarter to have your brain flash forward. And it was cool to hear Bonzi say, yeah, like, it was running through my mind, we're going to the finals in my hometown, because that's we can relate to that. It's premature. It looks in retrospect like overconfidence, but that's just a human emotion.
Yeah. And he was one of the younger guys, so he was a little more excitable. The veteran guys, when I asked, so did you think, you're up 16 late in the third, or you're up 15 with 10 to go in the fourth, are you thinking, this is it, we got it? And there were varying responses to that. But, I mean, the more polished and veteran guys were mostly like, you know, no, you always understand, blah, blah, blah. And Dunleavy said, absolutely not. I did not assume that for a second. I've been in too many games. Bob Whitsitt said, no, absolutely not. I've been in too many games. But Bonzi was one of the younger guys on that team and was excitable. And, you know, he was great regardless. He was just such a fun interview for this story because he's just so completely candid about it all. And he's got a really great perspective on it. That this was a great moment to be part of, even if they lost. And Dunleavy, it's funny. So Dunleavy's the one guy who has rewatched this, like, almost like maniacally so. Like, I don't know how many times.
He's talking about, like, missed rotations on corner shooters. I'm like, this guy needs to let this game go, man.
Oh, man. The level of detail that he could cite, I think because of how many times he's reviewed it, it's uncanny. Whereas everybody else was like, I'm never watching that game again. It's too painful. Bonzi did say that he rewatched, maybe just the fourth quarter, earlier this year because he wanted to see Kobe. And he said, as I rewatched it, I felt happy for Kobe in that moment, which is an interesting thing, kind of out of body experience for Bonzi 20 years later in a game that he's involved in, to see Kobe make the lob pass to Shaq. And in light of Kobe's passing, Bonzi just saying like it was, I wanted to watch that. I wanted to see Kobe in that moment. Something that didn't make the story that was also just a fun thing from Bonzi. He's saying that somewhere in the series, maybe it was before Game 7, because Game 7 was a Sunday, and Bonzi was saying, on that Saturday night, I'm at the hotel in bed at 10 o'clock because I knew I was going up against Kobe Bryant. And I knew that Kobe Bryant was not going to be out on a Saturday night before a playoff game. He was going to be home in bed or preparing, getting ready, whatever. And if Kobe's doing that, I got to do that. He says, Kobe, you know, nobody else but Kobe Bryant would make me be sitting in the hotel or going to bed at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night in L.A.
Well, first of all, you mentioned that you had, I mean, Kobe in this playoff run is, I think, 22 years old, 21 years old, maybe.
Turns 22 later that summer.
You mentioned kind of kicking around this story 4 years ago and executing it now this year. Kobe's not quoted in the story. Had he already passed away by the time that you kind of dove into it? Did you have preliminary discussions about trying to get him to talk about the game? I mean, he's quoted in old interviews on the Lakers TV network.
Yeah. It's actually not that old. The two quotes that I used, I think it was two, from Spectrum Sportsnet LA. Am I getting that right? It's a very long title they have. Their TV partner did a documentary last summer about the beginnings of the Shaq Kobe dynasty. And so they spent some time on this game and on that play, which I didn't even realize. I kind of found that by accident while I was doing the story, which thank God, because it did. The Kobe quotes are great, and I was able to put them into the oral history. No, so 4 years ago, I had done some very preliminary work, sketched out what I wanted to do, sketched out who I wanted to talk to, chatted with Bob Costas for a bit, talked to Jason Quick, who had been at the Oregonian covering that game as a sidebar guy. And of course, today is working at The Athletic, where he and Bill Oram teamed up on their version of this story. So I talked to Costas and Jason Quick, and I'd reached out to several of the participants. I didn't get anywhere, and then somebody shelved it. So it went into hibernation. By the time that this came back, it was because Kobe had passed.
Gotcha.
And all of a sudden, editors were like, hey, it's the 20-year anniversary coming up. Would you want to write about that game? I'm like, I wanted to. Yes, of course I want to write about this game. So 4 years ago, when I initially thought about this story, I actually wanted to do it more from the Portland side of it. It was more about this sliding doors moment, changing history, how great this Portland team was, that I thought it was one of the best teams of all time not to make the finals, that it's been forgotten, that I was so much more interested in the Blazers part of it. And then, you know, here we are in 2020. It's taken on a different context or a different meaning because of Kobe passing. And so the lob itself, not that it didn't always have great resonance, but I just think it was that much stronger now. And that plus the 20-year anniversary, you know, gave us an opening to do this. And I was still able to kind of weave in a lot of the Portland aspect as well.
Tiso is the official watch of the NBA, still undecided on a Father's Day gift. Father's Day is coming up soon. Tissot offers a variety of watches for dad, ranging from classic, sporty, and contemporary styles. Visit TissotWatches.com to explore the collections that best fit dad's everyday style. Tissot is a Swiss watch brand with a broad range of high-quality watches at attractive prices. They bring performance and style to the game by offering painstakingly accurate timekeeping and stylish and authentic watches. Tissot, this is your time.
Follow TISO.us on Facebook and Instagram and check out the hashtag ThisIsYourTime for more information about TISO.
Before we talk about Kobe, because I do think he's actually he's the appropriate lens on a lot of different levels to look into this story through, neither you nor The Athletic, this is a very important question. I just need to know. I need clarity on this. Neither of your stories has any quotes from Rasheed Wallace. What was, did Rasheed just not want to, I mean, Rasheed has a bad fourth quarter. He misses like a million shots. He was, however, an absolute destroyer that entire series. Just eviscerated the Lakers. They had no answer for him. It's one of it. I loved Rasheed Wallace then. I loved this game. I loved watching that series. Did he just not want to revisit the game?
Rasheed was an amazing, amazing player. And it's unfortunate that his career stats will never attest to that, and that that I think he kind of gets forgotten sometimes. Rasheed was incredible, and they had no answer for him. So I figured that the guys who were going to be hardest to get, I wasn't going to even try Sabonis because I know that he does very, very little, and I wasn't sure that there was much chance of him. My goal was to get at least five players from each team. And then as long as I got the right five or the good talkers, the guys who were had the best perspective, I'd be in good shape. And anything past that, I'd have too much anyway. When I spoke to Bonzi and Rasheed started a podcast of their own together within the last few months. And it's a lot of fun and they do a great job. And I watched them talk about this game on the YouTube version of their podcast. And so when I got Bonzi, we chatted and he said, I said, I'd really love to talk to Sheed. I know he's not great with the media. I know he's never really liked us much. I know that, you know, throughout his career, but you know, he did an interview with some local paper because he's coaching in high school down in, I think, North Carolina. And so I thought maybe there's a shot. And Bonzi says, I'll ask him for you. So Bonzi went to him a couple different times and I would check back with Bonzi occasionally. And the answer just kept coming back as, I guess, no, thank you.
I got to listen to that podcast because I'm dying to hear Sheed's thoughts on the game because Sheed was ahead of his time as a player.
Yes.
And the Lakers just had no answer for him other than just hope he misses these 15 footers over Robert Horry in the post or whoever is guarding him in the
AC
post.
AC Green, yeah.
Yeah. The guy was a monster. And he does hit a big three after the Shaq Kobe lob to pull Portland back within three and give him a chance to win the game in the last 30 seconds. We can talk about what happens after that. Let's talk about, Kobe and the lead up. So here's the lead up to this game. Here's the circumstance of this game. This is Phil's first year as coach of the Lakers. The previous two seasons have ended with the Shaq Kobe Lakers getting swept out of the playoffs. In 98, it's the Jazz, and in 99, it's the Spurs. And the Spurs series is a humiliation. I remember it at the time being a humiliation. I remember watching it with my college buddies and listening to all the commentary on ESPN and TNT about it, and it was reported and perceived as a humiliation for Shaq and Kobe as the more polished defense first team, playoff ready team, tougher team, embarrassing prima donna Lakers, not ready for the moment, no chemistry, blah, blah, blah. You go back and read the clips of that game. It's the last game in the Forum. The Spurs closed down the Forum. You go back. I reread some of the clips. Mario Elie, who's on that Spurs team, is talking so much about closing down the Forum and embarrassing the Lakers and how he wants to go steal a piece of the court with the letter L on it because they just hung some L's on the Lakers. According to the San Antonio News Express account, account of the game, Kobe was booed during the starting lineup introductions in Los Angeles in game four. And the crowd during the game was chanting for Eddie Jones, who had been traded to make way for Kobe. This is what the Lakers are perceived as when they meet the Blazers in the Western Conference Finals and what's at stake for them if they lose that series. Now, Shaq mentions in your story about, oh, I would have been traded if we lost. And everyone poo-poos that and says, no way, and says we would have probably traded everybody but Shaq and Kobe and rearranged the roster. But the Lakers, I mean, everyone knew they were going to be awesome. You don't get Shaq and Kobe on your team. Kobe was just 21 years old. He was just becoming what he was going to be. In a lot of ways, this playoffs was his breakout as a true blue NBA postseason superstar. But the Lakers were perceived as unready, particularly in comparison to the Spurs, as not a playoff tough team. And And this was a game where they had to wipe that perception away. I mean, you lived that. People, like, the Lakers were humiliated by the Spurs the year before.
Humiliated by the Spurs, swept by them, and as you mentioned, swept the year before that by Utah. And, of course, Shaq's Orlando career ends with him being swept in the finals. And so this running theme of Shaquille O'Neal can't win the big one. Shaquille O'Neal keeps getting swept, not just losing, but getting swept. That hung over him hard. Like, he went off on this whole other tangent that I did not include in the story about how he knew, if I don't do this, you guys are going to talk all this stuff. You guys are going to write all this stuff. And that really motivated me because I knew I can't let this happen again. That weighed on him a lot. Because, all right, Kobe was only 21, but Shaq was like, whatever, 26 at that point. And had already, you know, been in the league several years, had already been to the finals with Orlando. And here he is paired up with this young phenom in Kobe, and he's playing for the Lakers, and expectations are through the roof for, you know, Shaq used to say back in the day, he goes, you know, I know what it's going to be if we lose, you know, how they're going to blame it. It's, you know, first it's going to be, I don't remember if it was first me and then Dell, or first Dell, then me, or whatever. And of course, eventually Dell Harris got fired. But he knew, he understood that that's what it means to be the franchise star. And it was more on him than Kobe at that time, because Kobe was young and was not established as a franchise centerpiece yet, even though his potential was boundless. So, but it's an important point, Zach, and it is among the other things that I wanted to really emphasize in this story, that the Lakers were not the Lakers yet. And yeah, they won 67 games, which at that time was one of the best records of all time, top, you know, five or whatever of all time, but it wasn't expected. The LA Times had the Lakers as fifth in the West in their preseason rankings. Sports Illustrated picked the Spurs. Vegas had the Spurs. A bunch of newspapers, that was most predictions back then, was newspapers. They were all either Blazers or Spurs coming out of the West. I couldn't find one. I didn't look at all of them. I didn't have that much time. But I did not find in my search a single paper that picked the Lakers to win the West that year, much less the championship. They were immature. That supporting cast, people were constantly, even after they won the first championship, by the next year it was back to, well, who's going to be the starting power forward? And of course they trade Glenn Rice for Horace Grant. Horace is older at that point, but it was always Robert Horry isn't big enough and strong enough to guard the Karl Malones and the, you know, the Rasheed Wallaces and the Tim Duncans and the Chris Webbers, like, you know, Robert Horry, cause you know, he was more of this kind of like, you know, skinny, almost a small forward in Houston. Yeah, I think he played a little of both.
Horry has a quote in your story about how Phil was always trying to get rid of him and get off of him and didn't want him on the team. I'm like, how did Phil not like? How does any coach not love Robert Horry? Like he's a prototypical 3-and-D guy, guards a lot of positions. He's the greatest entry passer of all time. That's what one coach told me about him one time, which is like a thing that only coaches would care about and love. Like, how did so? What's that about? Like, is it just about what you're talking about now?
Yeah, I think Phil, like, in his mind, a power forward was more of your traditional manly man power forward who banged in the post and, you know, rebounded in high numbers and whatever, maybe set hard screens. I don't know. Robert was more of this kind of 3-4 type. And yeah, he was a, you know, an early version of the 3-point shooting, big, if you could call him a big. And Robert was a really clever defender. But he was not a particularly physical defender. So yeah, Karl Malone would overmatch him and some of the other guys could overmatch him. But Robert became a really great defender at that position just with his guile and his knowledge of how guys played. Robert's an incredibly smart player. And so eventually I think he did win Phil over in that regard. And he did start, I think, for their third championship when they played the Nets. But, you know, the first few years, and this was the fans too, by the way, fans and media. Talk radio, it was always Derek Fisher isn't good enough. We need a better starting point guard. Derek Fisher can't stay with the Damon Stoudemires of the world or Allen Iverson or whatever. And it was always Robert Horry can't guard these guys. So those two in particular were always targeted by fans and media. And there was always this question. And so, you know, Harp was older. Brian Shaw was older. So it wasn't just whether or not Shaq and Kobe were getting along and were mature enough as a duo. It was always this supporting cast, there were all these doubts about them, which is funny because, as you and I have discussed before, all anybody looks back on now is they're a dynasty. They were amazing. They won three in a row and they had Shaq and Kobe. So of course they were dominant, but they weren't that dominant. They're this close to not winning in 2000. They're this close to not winning in 2002. And that's the great sliding doors moment that I wanted to explore here in part was if they lose this, not only are the Blazers winning the championship that year, but then the Blazers probably stay together. The Lakers, even if they keep Shaq and Kobe together, and I think they would have, I don't think Shaq was.
Yeah, you don't trade. You don't trade one of those guys.
No, that would have been crazy. But Rick Fox and Robert Horry are right. The rest of them, there would have been major consequences. And when we see, looking back, knowing what the great chemistry of that team was and how those guys were such great glue pieces, smart, veteran, ball movers, defenders, that I'm talking about Fox and Fish and Ori and Shaw and Harp. Like, if those guys don't stay together, whoever's replacing them, the chemistry is probably not the same. Like, these things matter.
One of the reasons that the Blazers have disappeared from the discourse, as you mentioned, is A, they disappeared their own team with one of the all-time asinine win-now trades, which is Jermaine O'Neal for Dale Davis, and Jermaine O'Neal immediately goes to Indiana. It's like, oh yeah, he's good. All the stuff he was doing in practice, turns out he could do it in games. Mike Dunleavy just didn't play him, and in Mike Dunleavy's defense, that team is legitimately 13, 14 deep. But that was Jermaine O'Neal's fourth season. It wasn't like his first season as the teenage rookie coming in out of high school sitting on the bench. That was his fourth season in Portland. He never played 900 minutes in any of those four seasons. That is incredibly unusual for a first-round pick to just not basically play for 4 years in a row. And they eventually like, all right, the coach isn't going to play him. Bob Whitsitt said he's made a promise to Jermaine. If the coach doesn't play you, I'm going to trade you. And they make this win-now trade, which everybody knew when it happened. Even though Jermaine O'Neal had never played, well, that's dumb. And then they trade Brian Grant for Sean Kemp, which was a disaster, but effectively exchanged those two. But the other reason is the Kings rise up and become the Lakers' sort of short-term rival in absolute classic playoff series and obviously very controversial playoff series in 2002. And then the team that sort of is hovering around that discussion and outlasts all of them is the Spurs. And what's interesting about this season, 2000, the one you wrote about, it's the only season in 6 years that the Lakers and Spurs did not meet in the playoffs. 99 is the sweep, and then every year in the three-peat, and then the .4 shot, and then the year the Spurs went in 2003. So every year from 2000 to 2004, five straight years they meet in the playoffs. This is the gap year. And it's the year, people forget this, it's the year when the Spurs sit Duncan from the playoffs. Duncan gets injured at the end of the season. I think he has a meniscus tear, wants to come back, is working to come back. Pop has subsequently said, yeah, we thought about it. We actually don't know if we made the right call. We hope we did for his, we think in retrospect we did for his longevity. So the Spurs sort of vanish off the face of the earth for this particular playoffs. Other than that, the Spurs and the Lakers, I love that rivalry. It feels like there's not, that rivalry, to meet 5 out of 6 years in the playoffs is really rare and awesome. And yet it doesn't feel like we talk about that rivalry enough. And I'm not quite sure why that is. But this was the only year they didn't meet. And I think one of the missing questions about that playoff run for the Lakers is boy, would we have liked to have seen a rematch of that sweep and all those storylines colliding.
Yeah, and I think, is it the Spurs? Did they lose to the Suns that year with Duncan?
I believe they got swept or maybe won one game. They got hammered. I think they get swept by the Suns.
Yeah. So it's, and it's funny too, because even with the Lakers, when I asked them, you know, where did this Blazers team in 2000 rank of all the teams that you guys had to go through in the three-peat? And a lot of them said they were the best team, or it was maybe a really thin separation between them and the 2002 Kings, and nobody mentioned the Spurs at all. And then when I put it in a different way to Shaq and asked about toughest team, and he says, yes, they were the toughest. I'm like, tougher than the Spurs? And he said, yeah, tougher than... Like, it's weird that the Lakers don't go out of their way
them. I think it feels like they never met at the peak of their powers together, which is
that
strange.
That might be it.
Well, but in 2001, which is the Lakers' second title and the one where they just, they go 15-1 in the playoffs and just obliterate everything in their path. Yeah. They faced each other in the Western Conference Finals that year. It's the only time they faced each other in the Conference Finals, and the Lakers, to say that they, returned the humiliation from 1999 onto the Spurs is actually putting it gently. They run over the Spurs like a Mack truck, and like the scores of the last two games, it's like 111-70 and like 110-75. I mean, they just absolutely, I don't even know what the right word is. They just run them over like a Mack truck. And like to look at those score, I mean, I remember those games and I remember that particular Lakers team in 2001, the second title team, feeling utterly indestructible. But to look at those scores and see a Tim Duncan team losing by that many points and getting swept is like, oh my God.
Yeah. And the Spurs, you know, that's still, so it's, we still got Duncan and Robinson together, but perimeter wise, they don't have the weapons. And it's honestly hard for me to remember back to how those series unfolded. But, you know, Duncan and Robinson together, of course, that's as tough of a big man tandem as Shaq is going to have to deal with.
It's a 58 win team that the Lakers squash like a 15 win team.
And that was when that was like the only year where you could say the Lakers were truly dominant in the playoffs. They played with fire all the time. They played with fire throughout the 2000 postseason. They played with fire in 2002. And, you know, as great as they were in the abstract or in the totality of their run, it's, you know, there were just some weird glitches with those Laker teams. And, you know, the Spurs should rate a higher number in this whole pecking order of their rivals for then. And I think in the totality of it, if you take the entire Shaq Kobe run from 96 to 04, the Spurs stand as the biggest rival, in terms of number of times met and some key moments. But somehow the Kings and Blazers, I just think the nature of a 7-game series and how testy those series got and how close those teams were to keeping them from the finals in the last possible moment, I think just somehow stand out more.
And the Lakers, and again, four of the Spurs series of the five were second round series, which is sort of naturally kind of less memorable, fewer eyes on it than when there's only one game a night and it's a berth at the finals. Is that Stig? You've made this point very artfully many times that like the Lakers three-peated, but two of them were really, really fragile and on the brink of, like, they're very close to winning only one title in 3 years, which would be perceived as a disappointment. But they do win all three. And I think the nature of basketball, you know, when these superstar teams get together, they're unbeatable. They've joined up. The odds are unfair. And yes, when the superstars join up, they generally are going to contend for titles for a long time. And like there are 25 other teams who can't win and all that. But to actually win in the end, to be the last team standing, is hard even for those teams because of injuries and wear and tear and chemistry. Now, the Warriors, I think, were an exception because they collected four stars, and that was kind of unprecedented. The level of star power on the Warriors was unprecedented. And yet, I think this Lakers team, there's no, you don't lose points for barely winning the championship. You don't lose points for having shaky, fragile championships bookending the three-peat. You don't, because it's hard every time. They won three, period. They got three. And I think all of the focus has always been on the what if of Shaq and Kobe. What if they could have gotten along? How many could they have won? And the what if is tinged with disappointment, right? The subtext is they didn't win as many as they should. I would prefer, maybe I'm trying to be optimistic, I would prefer to look at it the other way. I think they're going to age well. Because if you look at what's happened before them, the Celtics of the 80s and the Lakers of the 80s did not three-peat. The Bulls did twice, but those teams did not. After them, the Spurs never repeated, let alone three-peated. The Heat with LeBron could not manage a three-peat. The Warriors could not manage a three-peat. These teams keep rising and they seem inevitable and unbeatable and they can't win three in a row. The Lakers won three in a row. It's unbelievably rare, and I think they should be celebrated for that more than the what ifs and the controversies. Like, they won three. Nobody does that. Very few teams ever do it.
So yeah, of course, I am guilty of this, Zach. I've said it many times. I like pointing out how fragile the three-peat was, maybe because I lived through it and saw it in real time and felt it in real time, how fragile it was. And it's not to diminish it by any stretch.
No, my point is it doesn't diminish it. It actually lifts it up.
It does, and it also does help, to your point, underscore just how tough it is and sometimes how close these things are to not happening. And if you were to go back through history, you could probably find a lot of these little potential sliding doors moments or, you know, the I love Phil Jackson's turn on a trifle phrase, but there are a lot of these championships that turned on a trifle probably that could have gone the other way. And it's been 18 years 18 years since the Laker three-peat, which makes me feel really old, but that nobody else has done it, and we have had some incredible teams. The Lakers were not a super team. Yeah, they had Shaq and Kobe, and they're both top five players, but again, Kobe's 21 at the beginning of that run, and they never really had a third all-star. They brought in Glenn Rice to kind of be the third star, but Glenn Rice, if you look at what he did for that team, he was fine, but they were able to easily flip him for an older Horace Grant and not think twice about it when Glenn Rice priced himself out. And they needed a power forward more than they needed him because they had Rick Fox. So they never really had a third star. And now we're talking about teams with three stars and four stars and super teams. And, you know, starting with that Celtics team, this whole era of super teams. And none of them have won three in a row. And so I think you're right. I think the longer we go, the more history will smile on what Shaq and Kobe accomplished. In terms of the whole, you know, regret and did they leave titles on the table and all this, I'll give you just the short version, which is at the time that they broke up, which was my last year covering the team in 04 after losing the Pistons, I thought that way. I thought this is a tragedy. These two guys should suck it up, figure it out. They just blew it. Like, I still think to this day, despite Karl Malone's injury, despite Gary Payton not liking the triangle, despite the aging issues they had with that roster, they still could have beaten the Pistons if Shaq and Kobe were actually on the same page and not running away from each other as fast as they possibly could, because they knew the breakup was coming. They were done with each other. And that lack of cooperation just poisons everything else. So at the time, I thought it was a tragedy in some regard, that I thought this team, that those two could have won more together. The reality is this. The salary cap at that time was much lower than it is today, of course. The luxury tax had just come in a few years before. Shaq had been grandfathered in. His salary had been grandfathered in before the concept of max contracts existed. Shaq had what was essentially a super duper quadruple max. And was
Shaq, he would have nicknamed it like a Shax or a Shaq Max. Or he would have like, created some nickname for it.
I got the Shaq Max.
Yeah, something like that.
So Max is Shaq. There we go. He and Kevin Garnett, they had the two contracts that broke the system and forced the lockout in 1998. And so, but they got grandfathered in. So they kept getting, you know, the raises on top of their old, you know, huge salaries, and everybody else was now limited to at that time, like $16 million as a starting salary. Shaq plus Kobe was already at the cap or pretty close to it. And so the Lakers, they're getting older in 2004. Rick Fox is just, you know, decaying. Horace Grant is just done. Karl Malone got hurt that year. Like, they just didn't have any core around them. And when you're drafting low every year, you start to erode. We saw that with the Miami Heat of LeBron and Wade. Even by year four, you're just eroding. The cast is eroding. So the Lakers could not have replenished very well around them unless Shaq was going to take a pay cut. And the opposite of that was happening. Shaq was asking for a max 3-year extension that Jerry Buss was balking at, which had a lot to do with the trade to Miami also. It wasn't just about Kobe. So I don't know that there was any, if Shaq and Kobe had just decided, we're sticking this out together and we're going to get along and we're going to be the best version of ourselves with each other. Their salaries and cap issues and the aging of that roster would have made it incredibly challenging to get the right guys around them.
Now more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and by reducing emissions. That's good. And right now, you can get 5 cents off every gallon every day with Make It Count rewards from Marathon. Plus, you can earn points for additional savings on fuel, airfare, hotels, and more. This is definitely a deal you can count on. It's quick and easy to join. Just download the free Make It Count app or go to makeitcount.com/radio and start saving today. This offer is valid only at participating Marathon stations. Remember, wherever you need to go, be safe. The people at Marathon are behind you all the way.
Let's talk about the game, because you were at the game. Your story is about the game. I remember in the moment watching it with allegedly with money on the line, although I haven't paid my dues on this, feeling it's one of the all-time sky is falling and you can't do anything about it games. It just keeps, they keep missing, the Lakers keep making plays, and it begins to just feel, once it just be, it like it's all cascading, everything is falling apart. And watching it again in preparation for this, it still feels that way. And Steve Smith has a quote about, I don't know if it's in yours or the other one, where he's like, we could have just taken shot clock violations and it would have just been about the same in terms of how they missed 13 straight shots, all that. What stuck out to you about either watching the fourth quarter now all these years later, or talking to the Blazers or the Lakers about sort of like what the hell happened here?
On the Blazers side of it, there is no one thing to point to. And the interesting thing about the way the Blazers see this game all these years later, Dunleavy, as we said, has examined it down to the last tiniest detail and says, I don't think I did anything wrong. Like, he's confident in every decision he made. He feels really good about the way he coached that game. The players say, we got good shots, we just missed them. And I think for the most part, you can look at that and say that, although I'll come back to that one in a second. The players all feel like, we didn't do anything wrong. It's not like we started like kicking the ball into the third row. They just couldn't make shots anymore. And it's not like I think maybe the Laker defense maybe turned up a little bit. I don't know how you gauge that. It didn't look substantially different than in the third quarter to me in terms of that part of it. But the Laker role players really played a huge role. Now, there's a point there where Shaq and Kobe combined for like 8 straight points or something for the Lakers. But before that, it's, you know, Brian Shaw hitting a couple of threes and Robert Horry hitting a three. And then there's a point where Robert Horry gets his own rebound, dribbles out, and it's a very Robert Horry play where he just kind of casually dribbles back out to the arc, turns around.
There are these plays, man. There are these plays. And if you're a Blazers fan, the Brian Shaw banks in a three at the end of the third quarter to pull the Lakers within 12.
13.
And it's just one of those, every game like this has a shot like that. Like the Clippers Rockets comeback from 2015 has the Josh Smith, Corey Brewer random threes. There's always just like stuff that when it happens, you're like, ooh, that one, that seems bad. And the Horry one is Shaq is just so big that it takes two of the Blazers to try to box him out on that play and they can't corral the rebound and it bounces to Robert Horry, who just dribbles backward and shoots a three. And you're like, well, okay, I guess those are the ones that stuck out to me. Like, those are the kicks in the balls if you're Portland, those shots.
Yeah. But it is funny that the way the Blazers view it themselves, or not view it because they refuse to view it aside from Mike Dunleavy, is that they really don't have, like, some major regret. It's not, and Scottie Pippen was the only one, and Scottie was the one to say this, and it was interesting. There's another piece of Scottie's quote that I did not get a chance to use, but Scottie was the one who said we weren't getting the right shots, and everybody else says we got good shots, we just missed them. Even when I asked, did you get tight? That's the obvious reporter question, right? Did you guys get up tight? Did you start to feel the pressure? The moment, and they don't even feel that. They don't even say that. Now I would say that there are some shots that maybe look a little rushed. A couple of threes in particular, a couple of deep, you know, this is an era when the mid-range was fine, but there's some mixed 16 and 18 footers in there that look like maybe they could have worked for a better shot. Nobody could stop Rashid going inside, as we were talking about earlier, so maybe they should have been, you know, trying more for Scotty post-ups, Rashid post-ups, Bonzi post-ups, because like in the post, the Lakers had a very difficult time with those guys. And, but that's not the way it unfolded. So Scotty's the only one who said, we didn't get the right shots. And to him, that was an indication of, among other things, we hadn't been together that long. Scotty, Steve Smith, and Detlef Schrempf had all been brought in the prior summer, so it's their first year together with this group. You've got the holdovers in Stoudemire and a young Bonzi and an older, you know, Arvydas Sabonis. And Scotty just felt like, you know, maybe the chemistry and the trust wasn't there, and especially for a game 7 on the road. And he said, like, it's Scotty's view, where they lost this was in not getting home court advantage. They're tied on like February 22nd or something. They play in Portland. I think it's the last of the four games between them. The Lakers win that and they go on to just storm down the stretch of the season while the Blazers go like 500 or something. And that's the difference in their records. The Lakers end up with home court. It matters in game 7. Scotty thinks if it's at the Rose Garden, they win it. And
it's another parallel with the 98 Pacers, because Larry Bird on the first day of training camp tells the team, we have to have game 7 at home against the Bulls. First day of camp, says number one goal this season, we've got to get the number one seed, because if we play Chicago in game 7, it has to be in Indiana. And yeah, they don't get the number one seed in the games in Chicago and they lose.
The other funny thing about the Scottie Pippen element, Zach, so the Lakers had wanted to acquire him. The Blazers get him. And while Phil and Scottie are obviously fond of each other, Phil is Phil. So he's like trying to tweak him. Like I think in the lead up to that series, if I'm recalling correctly, like he kept saying, Scotty has to lead them. If he doesn't lead them, they're not getting anywhere. Like he's trying to, he's totally trying to bait him and put this on him. Scotty told me, that, you know, we were really well prepared because I knew everything Phil was doing. I knew his offense. I knew, like, I had these guys trained essentially. But when it came down to the leadership in that fourth quarter, this leadership idea, when I asked any of them about, well, who was the leader of this team? Who should have bailed you guys out? Who saves you from this? Who prevents this from happening? Who's your go-to guy? Who's the heart of your team? And I got all these different answers from all the different Blazers. And what Scotty eventually ended up saying, and this is a quote that did not make the story, was, I felt like it was just my first year there. And so here he was with his 6 championship rings and this aura from the Bulls dynasty. He didn't feel like he was the one who was going to make demands of these guys. Yes, he told them what they should do in terms of defending against the triangle. But he said to me that he really didn't feel like he could put an imprint leadership-wise.
Interesting.
He couldn't really speak up and be the one to pull guys along or get them in line, because this was a really veteran team that predated him, and it had, you know, guys with a lot of standing on their own, like Steve Smith and Sabonis. So so that was interesting.
I watched it with I mean, Scotty was never wired or really didn't have the skill set to just take over games. That wasn't how he played. He wasn't just going to go score. That's just not wasn't in his wheelhouse. I watched it, and I get what the Blazers are saying by we got the shots we wanted to get, because that season they were a very slow-paced team. They took an above-average-ish amount of twos. They worked the post a lot, and that's what they did in the fourth quarter. They worked the post a lot, and they took a lot of twos, and they missed a lot of twos. So I get what they're saying. However, I viewed it as, and neither story mentioned this, I'm watching the game, and I'm thinking, when you say they don't have a go-to guy and like there's too many A-minus players and not an A-plus player, there's no hierarchy, what they really didn't have on the floor was someone who could beat the defense off the dribble. And that, and so their way of penetrating the defense was to throw the ball into the post. And that's fine. That worked for them a lot. But like Scotty, they were going under screens on Scotty. He couldn't get downhill. Steve Smith could barely get the ball up the court. He wasn't like a get a lot of separation guy off the dribble. They just didn't have an off the dribble. And I kept thinking, I wonder, the one name that wasn't mentioned enough is that I kept wanting them to put in, even though I know they didn't, was I would have thrown Damon Stoudemire in the game just to give me a little north-south speed, just to give me someone who could get – he didn't play in the fourth quarter until there's 40 seconds left in the game. He doesn't play the whole quarter. And I would have just thrown him in there, just give me someone who can get into the paint off the dribble, draw some help, and like get the ball moving a little bit, because the Blazers had a ton of great players on the court. They had a ton of size. They didn't have anyone who could beat anybody off the dribble, and I think that, more than their shot selection and more than not knowing who the man was, that was their undoing in the game.
So here's the funny thing. So Bonzi and Steve Smith and Scotty all talk about how their strategy was to have their bigger guards go at Kobe, post him up, get him 94 feet away from the other basket, wear him down and all this. And Damon Stoudemire does tell me about how, like, he would start out on Kobe because it was just kind of like to, you know, play mind games with
him.
They baited
him. Into posting up on offense and then posted him up on defense. So Kobe's that was really really fascinating part of your story.
So they go with both strategies. Small with Damon Stoudemire baits Kobe. Bigger with the other guys, they can try to wear him down physically. And in the I was looking this back up before we got started today. The third quarter, the Blazers are up 50-49 in the third with about 6 minutes to go, and Bonzi comes in at that point, and it's while Bonzi's in that they build a 16-point lead. And Damon doesn't play really in the fourth. So, among the things that did not make my story, Bob Whitsitt, and now you can see Dunleavy and Whitsitt really go back and forth about the trades of Jermaine O'Neal.
There's some disagreement there between coach and GM.
And Brian Grant. Yeah, no love lost between Dunleavy and Whitsitt. Here's what I did not use. This is Bob Whitsitt talking. This is not a dump on Mike kind of thing at all, meaning Dunleavy. But then he goes and dumps on him. He says, Phil likes big guards. He doesn't pressure you. He doesn't have what I call a classic point guard who's going to go 20-10 on you. He likes big guards. So we had a team that could go big, bigger, and big. And we could go small if we had to. But our success was when we used more of our big lineup and less of Damon Stoudemire. And then he says, But for whatever reason, we kept wanting to play Damon a lot when our bigger success is when we had the bigger lineups in there. So he's just killing Mike's decision to go with so much Damon Stoudemire in that series. Now, if you look for the series,
his minutes go wildly up and down. He's 13 minutes one game, 30 the next.
And Stoudemire averages like 24 minutes a game in that series, or 25 minutes a game, and Bonzi averages 17 minutes a game in that series. So Whitsitt is convinced all these years later they should have had more Bonzi, less Damon. And of course, you're making the case for why Damon actually was actually important to them, and I think Dunleavy would obviously agree with you.
Except they didn't play him in the fourth quarter at all. I mean, look, they'd
gotten their lead with Bonzi. I don't know if that, like, I didn't ask him that particular thing, but I don't know, it was funny.
I would be in, go back and ask him and then report back on the next podcast, because I would have asked him that question. It's as gutting as losses get in the NBA, and you know, it did change things for both franchises. It you know, but back to Kobe. So he has 25, 11, and 7 in this game. He outplays Shaq for the most part in this game. And then, of course, they get to the finals, and Kobe has, I think, his first capital M moment, which is he gets injured. He sprains his ankle in game 2, sits in game 3, doesn't play. The Pacers win game 3. It's 2-1, comes back for game 4. Game goes to overtime, and Shaq fouls out. And Kobe has – Shaq fouls out with like 2.5 minutes left in overtime. And Kobe has a 3 minutes of just like jump shots, a tip in to ice the game. And the Lakers go up 3-1. They win on the road in Indiana, I believe, in that game. And that's probably 2 weeks after this game or something like that. And that's – all of this is sort of Kobe's cementing himself like, oh, yeah, this guy's going to be a guy that likes the moment and can play in the moment.
And in that series in the finals, you know, he averages like 15, 6, and 4 or something. It's nothing that leaps off the page. And Shaq is just a – friggin' beast. Like, he's 38-15 and whatever. Like, Shaq just destroys the Pacers in that series, and Kobe plays very much the supporting role, but they don't win game 4 without him. And the fact that he was doing it on that ankle that had kept him out of game 3, and that we thought he might miss multiple games, that was the thing. When Kobe went down, go back and watch that. That's the Jalen Rose stepping under Kobe play, which he now admits years later, I kind of wanted to, I didn't want to injure him, but I wanted to hurt him, or some weird distinction that Jalen has made. And we weren't sure if Kobe was going to play again or how many games he might miss, so that he was back in game 4 at all, not to mention saving them in overtime after Shaq fouls out. Critical. And even in that moment, that night, and the next day, the entire conversation was this kid who everybody was saying, oh, well, he plays a little like Jordan and he wants to be like Jordan, but he's not Jordan. And he's got some nerve trying to be like Jordan. Da, 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 da. That moment was when everybody said, oh, wow, okay. Maybe he does have some Jordan in him. Maybe there is something really special here, and that he can rise to a moment that he can really, you know, deliver in this huge, huge moment on the road in Indiana with this game and the series kind of in the balance. And, it did. Like, that was the lob to Shaq is like a moment for them together, but game 4 against the Pacers is like Kobe's first true singular moment.
Well, it's a great story. Did a great job with it. Everyone can go to Bleacher Report and read Howard's story on the lob 20 years later. Before we go, any quick thoughts on the NBA's 22 team play-in tournament extravaganza to restart the season? What are your first impressions? What do you like? What do you not like? What do you got in mind?
Quick hitters on this. I would have been fine with 16 teams. I understand why you want 22. A lot of that has to do with money, TV games.
Not a lot. The whole thing. All of it. That's it.
Your employer and mine both will be happy to have all those extra TV games. But I think 16, if we were talking about just safety, which is why the season was shut down in the first place, was about health and safety, then the highest bar for health and safety, if you're going to play at all, would be just go with the 16 teams and get the playoffs going.
If you're just talking about health and safety,
you don't do it at all.
No sports league is playing right now. I mean, that's the assumption that you have to make and get past if you're going to talk about this at all. There is no governing health body that right now would say, yes, congregate, sweat, and hit each other in an indoor space frequently. That's like, you would not play. I'm not making light of it.
Yeah.
If health were the only reason you would do this, there wouldn't be sports. That's it.
There's the most puzzling part of this, Zach, is this discussion of how And we're going to do social distancing in the arena. When guys are not playing, they'll be sitting in different rows with masks on. What's the point of that? You've just like banged into each other, sweated on each other, breathed on each other, screamed at each other, talked smack at each other.
And I'm not making light of it by saying that no governing health body would recommend this. I'm saying it's a very serious thing. And
it absolutely is.
If you're going to restart, you better take every precaution. And like the NBA isn't the only sports league in the world restarting. Almost every sports league is trying to or currently or going to. So, but that's, that's the assumption you have to just sort of be able to live with. And frankly, it's not an easy thing to live with, I think, for the decision makers.
I do not envy any of them. Not the league, not the teams, not the players. No one. I would be very, very nervous, for all of them. I am nervous for them. And, I would have preferred, as I say, fewer teams, fewer bodies, less risk. That's just the basic math of this all. That's how this thing works. So, but that's fine. I understand why they want 22. I understand the need for TV games. I understand the need for teams to be involved, to play, to feel relevant still, to not go 9 straight months without playing. All of this. Like, I get it. And I also think that the biggest caveat on all of this, for both good and bad, is that if they're not going to play a single game until July 31st, give or take, there's still a lot of time left for things to happen. And again, this could go either way. Maybe we're in a much, much better place as a country with regard to the virus by then, and maybe we are in the midst of a second wave that actually throttles this whole thing for all we know. So I've been trying to withhold too much judgment, just in the sense that our lives, our world, our surroundings have changed so many times, so dramatically in the last few months, that trying to anticipate where we'll be on July 31st is foolish. But I have no doubt that the NBA, you know, I know that they have an exhaustive list of protocols that are being finalized that we'll learn about soon. And I have no doubt that those will be the best that anybody can do under the circumstances. But the circumstances are still, you're bringing together hundreds of people, thousands of people trying to play a bunch of games. And by definition, it's going to come with some risk. And, you just hope for the best. I'm also really, like, honestly, again, this is where we all play amateur epidemiologist. The idea that if somebody tests positive, they're only going to isolate the one guy so that they can just keep going feels risky to me.
That's what they're going to do.
You know, yeah, that is what they're going to do. And we'll see how it goes.
Well, I think they're, you know, look, there's no foolproof way to do it, but I think their hope is, we're going to test people every day.
Yeah.
And we're going to take people's temperature frequently. And in doing so, we are going to close as many of the spread windows as possible, totally shut. Because if you talk to sports scientists and experts on this, you know, the word asymptomatic gets thrown around a lot. Like, oh, the asymptomatic super spreader. And in a lot of cases, asymptomatic is actually sort of a misnomer. Because if you take their temperature, they do have symptoms. They might have a 99.3 and not feel it. And the hope is that as soon as we find that 99.3, you're out. You're being isolated. You may feel fine, but that's a symptom. And so that, like, the frequency with which they do that, we will hope, they hope to close as many windows as possible, but there's no way they can close them all. There will be windows where there is somebody who has it and they don't know, and there's a practice. And what happens there is, you know, we'll see. I mean, I do know that a lot of people in the league remain very surprised that only two people with the Jazz got it, when two players had it and were around each other. And so people, that's just one isolated case, but there's no way to close all the windows. The best they can do is close as many as they can.
And we will never know, Zach, how many guys had it and it just wasn't reported out because the league had no obligation to. But once they shut down, you know, there was some self-reporting and some, you know, players here, players there. Maybe there were more. There probably were more that we don't know about, or there almost certainly was. And so, look, and on the competition side of it, the only thing my only thought is this. I understand the need for more games rather than fewer because of revenue concerns, which are not unimportant, but the longer they're down there, the more risk there is. The longer they're down there, the more of a burden it is, not just to players, but to all the NBA personnel and teams and everybody else who have to be there for up to 90 days potentially. And, you know, they could have compressed this. You know, did you have to go 8 play-in seeding games or whatever they're going to call them? Did you have to stick with best of 7 in every round? I don't think so. Like, there were ways to speed this up and condense it and make it more, less risk, more efficient, less onerous. And they didn't. They're going for the max number of games they can squeeze out without going to 30 teams. And, you know, we won't know if that was the right call and what consequences came with that for a while.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's just, again, there's not going to be a right answer to how to do it. The right answer is probably you don't do it, but no one seems to be going that direction. The direction is, can we do it safely? But the ramp up games, 8 struck me as a lot too, but then you get into the, you know, can you go 0 to 60 that fast? You know what I mean? Like, are there going to be even preseason games or whatever? The games that don't count to the standings, because if you make these guys go right to playoff level intensity, your risk of an injury, increases. And there are some people in the sports science community that are actually more worried about that than they are about the virus, more worried about a spate of hamstring tears and this and that. And, you know, we'll see whatever comes to fruition, but it's an unknown, and it's June 8th. And as you said, there's a lot of time between now and even when there's approximately a month, I think, before teams are going to start going to Orlando. And there's a lot that can happen in that time. So the NBA is watching every league that's playing now to see how it all unfolds. And, you know, it's scary and it's an unknown, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. You know, we're all hoping for the best, obviously. We're hoping for great basketball, no injuries and no virus. Right. And, but all those things are in the mix there. And look, you know, stepping back from the serious matters of it all, it's just going to be fascinating. Fascinating to watch these guys playing with no fans. Fascinating just to see what this looks like with no home courts and no anything. Like, it's just going to be bizarre. And when we all start talking about, like, how we're going to perceive it, an asterisk, no asterisk, all this stuff, I don't know how we're going to judge it until we actually see it. Like, it is such a eye of the beholder thing, and it is such an in-the-moment thing that until we actually see these games being played and how it unfolds, I just don't know how we're going to classify it, contextualize it, until it actually gets here. And,
The asterisk discussion is the least interesting discussion of all of it to me. But like you said, we're going to see what happens, and there's a lot we're going to learn in the next month. Howard Beck, writes for Bleacher Report, just wrote about The Lob, has a podcast called The Full 48 that has a very interesting gamut of guests. You've done a good job. The pandemic guest list has been eclectic. It's been all over the place in a good way. I may be making an appearance on that next week, spoiler alert, and, I will try to come prepared, Howard. I know there's always something you spring on me when I go on The Full 48. There's always a list that I have to react to. There's always something. So I got to get it, be on my A game.
Now you're putting the pressure on me to come up with something clever in the next week, which now I'm absolutely going to.
Thank you, sir. Be well, be safe, and best to your family.
Thanks, you too, Zach. Appreciate it.